You're listening to The Point. John Abrams is founder of South Mountain Company, a design, build, and renewable energy company on Martha's Vineyard. He led the company through the transition to employee ownership. His new book describes the benefits of the employee ownership model and provides a blueprint for other small businesses. The book is titled From Founder to Future. Good to see you. Welcome
Great
back.
Great to see you, Mindy. It's been a while.
So reading this, I wondered, who did you write this book for?
Well, let me give you a little context.
Okay.
So from the 1930s to the 1970s, the unions helped build a prosperous middle class by getting wages and benefits to working people. And at the end of that time, the average corporate CEO made about 20 times the average working person. As that has climbed up to 250, 300 times, if working people's wages had climbed at the same rate, the minimum wage would be about $100 an hour right now.
Yeah.
And nothing of that sort has happened. The Democratic Party, the Republican Party, working people have just been left all the way behind. And it feels to me, that's the 50 years when I worked at South Mountain Company, that nothing was really happening for working people. And at this point, Americans are desperate for those who will fight for them and a level playing field. So right now, we're at a watershed moment when 3 million American small businesses are owned by founders over 55.
Mm-hmm.
And something is going to happen to every one of those businesses. And trillions of dollars are going to change hands. And what is going to happen? You know, some of those are going to be passed down in families, but less than in the past. Some will be sold to a few key employees, but very few because people can't afford it.
Right.
And many of those businesses will unceremoniously close the doors because they can't find a buyer. And this is going to make gaps in community, gaps in Main Street, and jobs will be lost. But many of them are attractive to strategic buyers in private equity. And those companies that get bought by private equity will tend to be taken out of the community, carved up, taken apart, sold for parts, mission disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And many founders would love to see their business continue and the mission continue, but they don't know the options available to them.
Right.
And the people who advise them, the business brokers, the attorneys, the accountants, the bankers, they don't know these options. And neither do the 32 million employees that work in those 3 million businesses. That's who this book is for.
Yeah, I was saying, a little bit of everybody, right? So you note five transitions: ownership, leadership, mission, management, and governance and impact. And you write, don't expect to fully achieve all of these transitions. Few companies have, but you may want to hold them as your intended goalposts, even if it takes decades or generations to get all the way down the field. Elaborate a little bit on those five transitions, because then later in the book, you kind of remind us of these.
Mm-hmm. So the ownership transition is going to happen at some point because people age out. And so my hope is that in many cases will be to the employees, which is it's great for everybody because it rewards the owner for time and investment, and it rewards the employees who have helped to build it. Leadership is different. That will happen too, but it will happen intentionally or unintentionally. And it's much more, ownership is kind of transactional. Leadership is emotional and difficult to transition. So it's such an important one, and I advocate for disentangling it from ownership. Do the ownership thing early, mid-career, and then with a long runway to an intentional leadership transition. Management, collaborative management just works better.
And more heads than one, right?
It's better for everybody. And governance, too. Mm-hmm. Same thing. And then, there's business as usual, or there's what I call B Corp force for good. And so we now have this great mechanism for assessing how good a job we're doing as businesses for the environment, for social change, and for profit too. So that's the fifth one.
Yeah, and you can have all of those. And I'm going to have you explain B Corp in a minute, but some folks may not know that you had your own company, South Mountain Company. And this was, as you say, learn as you go, build the road as you travel endeavor. You were kind of ahead of the curve here. I mean, with the idea of employee ownership. So for folks who aren't familiar with South Mountain, sort of give us the summary.
Well, we were also way behind the curve.
In
this sense, not that curve, yeah. But we had no idea what we were doing when we started that business. We literally didn't, and actually there was a watershed moment when my friend Lee Halpern, who loved to follow our work and he liked the work, and he's looking at a house with us one summer, and he goes, "Oh my God, the work is beautiful. Are you making any money?" And I chuckled and said, "Now we seem to lose money on every job we do." And he said, "Well, Abrams, you've got a really unique idea here, subsidized housing for the rich." And it was like a dagger to my heart. And that was what inspired me to learn about business. I thought, oh my God, we should be able to make subsidized housing for people that need it. And we should also learn how business can be a force for good.
Yeah, you've got a good product, right? Now you just got to figure out how to market it right?
And how to run it, yeah. And how to manage it. And so business became a passion for me, and it became more of a passion than buildings.
Yeah. So you note the difficulties that followed the economic crash of 2008. You said, before you tell us why that's important, I love the experience of author Andre Gide that you related. I'm going to read this because this is so great. All right. So this is a trip he took to the Belgian Congo in 1925. "My party had been pushing ahead at a fast pace for a number of days. And one morning, when we were ready to set out, my native bearers, who carried the food and equipment, were found sitting about without any preparations made for starting the day. Upon being questioned, they said, quite simply, that they had been traveling so fast that they had gotten ahead of their souls and were going to stay quietly in camp for the day for their souls to catch up with them. So they came to a complete stop."
I love that, too.
And so while it may not have seemed so at the time, you say, looking back now, that the crash of 2008 was the second best thing that ever happened to, you say, us, because the first being, work co-op being first. But yeah. Talk a little bit about that, our souls catching up with us, what that meant to you.
Well, it was forced on us. As, there was, when the crash happened, there was this cascade of postponements. And suddenly we were looking at, we had for, at that point, 30-something years, everybody came to work every day of every week, of every month, of every year with productive work to do. And suddenly we were faced with the possibility that there wouldn't be. And so we had to figure out what to do about it. And one of the things that happened from that is, I had always thought, mistakenly, that my job was to protect people from stress and shoulder the burdens. It's embarrassing to me that it took me so long to learn that is not the job of a leader. The job of a good leader is to serve, but to include. And at that point, there was no way to not lay it on the table. Here's what's happening, everybody.
Yeah.
And what happened was everybody got engaged in the solution. What do we do? Never did layoffs come up. It was just, here's what we're going to do. We're in it together. And I will never forget the day when I announced to the company that everybody was going to take a 20% wage cut. And we did not have any idea when that would be restored. And after the meeting, people came up to me and thanked me. And I said, wait a minute, did you actually get what happened there? Mm-hmm. And they would say, yeah, but you're losing more than I am. And we're all in this together.
I was going to say, we're all in it together is the idea here. You retired from South Mountain in 2022, and you write, 2 years later, I can say unequivocally that South Mountain is not the company that I built by the seat of my worn and faded Levi's. It's the company that new leadership is guiding into uncharted terrain using tools, methods, and information barely imaginable a decade or two ago. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, I just want to say that it's thrilling to watch them do an incredible job. And we spent a long time, 7 years on and off, but really 3 years hunkered down, building the leadership capacity that we needed and to have this change of leadership. And there's a very aligned leadership team there. And they're of another generation entirely, and they look at things differently. They use information differently. They use consultants differently. And, I just think they're going to take it to places that my casual style of leadership may never have been able to do.
Yeah. All right, let's talk a little about mission and purpose. Ben and Jerry's mm-hmm. Ice Cream, as many know, is known for being socially responsible. You write, on April 11th, 2000, after a mighty struggle and against the wishes of co-founder and CEO Ben Cohen and other company leaders, Ben and Jerry's homemade ice cream was forced by law to sell to the premier socially oriented firm in America, to the multinational Unilever. Tell us a little bit about that struggle and the deal they were able to negotiate. I thought this is interesting because you feel powerless, like, you know, I built this and we've always been socially conscious, and what's going to happen? There's always another plan, right?
Yeah, well, they did have to sell, but they were able to negotiate that their social mission would be kept intact by the larger company. And, you know, Ben and Jerry's is still doing it today.
Yeah.
But what it really was such a wake-up call for the socially responsible business movement. And it was one of the inspirations for the B Corp movement. And B Corp is a designation that it's a certification. And it's run by an amazing nonprofit called B Lab, which started in 2007, I think. And they've done two things. One, this certification program, which is very rigorous and very difficult to achieve. And 8,000 companies worldwide are now B Corps. The other thing they've done is they have passed legislation, I think in about 37 states today, to allow corporations to be beneficial corporations. And the what the laws do is they allow companies to not only prioritize the bottom line and returns to shareholders. And so it puts a different kind of business mechanism in place. And for example, Patagonia, when that law was passed in California, Yvonne Chouinard was standing on the state house steps ready to sign right there, we are a beneficial corporation. And many have done that. And so that Ben and Jerry's moment, I think, had rippling impacts that continue to this day.
Yeah. We're talking with John Abrams about his book, From Founder to Future. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with John Abrams, founder of South Mountain Company on Martha's Vineyard and author of From Founder to Future, a business roadmap to impact longevity and employee ownership. Talk about the different research that you did for this book. You talked to different, Ben & Jerry's just one of the companies you hold up as an example. What were the surprises along the way?
Well, the thing that surprised me actually was that So this book really talks about the different major forms of employee ownership. And I'm such an advocate for the worker co-op that I had a lot to learn about the other parts. But what really surprised me is that when I got to the part of the book that is all about worker co-ops, I realized I actually don't know enough even to write this part. Mm. And so I made a list of people I wanted to talk to all over the country, some of whom I knew, many of whom I didn't. And I had to figure out how to get introductions to these people. And it was a variety of people. It was people that ran exemplary companies in my view. It was people that provide the infrastructure for employee ownership. People who help people start employee ownership or convert to employee ownership and finance employee ownership transitions. So it was the whole gamut. And I had this list of about 30 or 40 people. And what happened was two things. One, that everybody I would talk to would say, oh my God, you got to talk to so-and-so. And so it just became this rolling tide of more and more interviews. And the other thing was that I learned, I did all these interviews on Zoom and I recorded them and then I had them transcribed with AI. And what I found out is I got to be in those conversations. I didn't have to think about, I didn't have to remember anything. I didn't have to take notes. I did have to deal with, you know, 25 pages of text and extract the good stuff out of there. But it was a wonderful way to do it because I really got to know these people.
Yeah. And you've got all that kind of nitty gritty in the book too, all these details. There is a question of when is enough, right? And you have a story of the fisherman sitting on the beach with his wife. And after a big catch, a wealthy business entrepreneur heard about his success and approached him. And here's what it says. So he says, why didn't you keep fishing and bring in twice as much? He asked. Why? Said the fisherman. Because you could make more money, maybe buy another boat and hire some employees. Why? The fisherman asked again. You could keep growing, increase profits, and buy more boats. If you worked long and hard at it, after some years, you'd grow rich. Why would I want to do that? Because then you and your wife could retire and relax on the beach, said the business entrepreneur. But that's what I'm doing now, said the fisherman. Sometimes enough is enough.
I love that.
It's so funny because my grandson has a little book and it's the same story. It's a little mouse who's in Venice with his boat and somebody comes along and there's not enough room. They go, oh, you need a bigger boat. And see, he gets up, and then he goes across the ocean. He's got the scraper, but he's unhappy. And so he sells it all to get back to his little boat where he can go around and look at the sun, the moon, and, you know, sing his little song. So, yeah. So that's a question I guess people have to ask themselves, right? When is enough enough?
When's enough enough? And when is growth valuable and when is it just disruptive? But along those same lines, one of my favorite quotes in the book is this guy named Eric Reiger, who has a wonderful company in Chicago called Webbit. And he talks about, all his friends who have sold their companies to private equity. And he says, to a person, they've cashed their seven-figure checks and they're absolutely miserable. They sold their soul and they left their employees in the lurch. And so I call that the fat wallets and broken hearts syndrome. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when is enough enough?
Yeah, and what makes you happy?
Yeah.
Right? And the other thing I was saying, when you talk about your employees showing up every day, you know, they're invested. It's what they love to do. Everybody, like you said, win-win all the way around. I wonder how many other corporations could say all their employees show up for work every day, right, with a, you know, can-do attitude.
Well, employee ownership makes a huge difference in that.
Yeah, for sure. So what do you hope readers take away from the book?
Well, I have, I don't know, maybe this is where I overreach. I feel like I didn't know we would be in this particular time when the book got published, but I hope that it is in some modest way an antidote to what is becoming more and more the prevailing mindset in the U.S. today, the one of cruelty, not kindness, the one of concentrated wealth, not generosity. And this is, you know, this is a, yeah, the one that we saw in D.C. the other day on Saturday, and that we saw in Minnesota on Saturday, not the one that we saw in 2,000 communities all over the country. So I hope that this is in some way an antidote to that mentality, and that this is about, this is about a future when we all share in the bounty.
And I would say that I think because you're giving all of these different opportunities and you know, different ideas people could, it's hope, right? There's so many people right now who feel so hopeless that being, you go, wow, I didn't know, you know, I didn't know about B Corp. I didn't know about, you know, these different opportunities, that it maybe will spread some hope for somebody
it's
who's
thinking.
It's
definitely a hopeful book.
A very hopeful book, but I also love that it you know, if you're an entrepreneur thinking of starting a business, here, you're going to go in with your eyes wide open, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, it reminds me, the Kirkus review for this book said about me, not all readers may share his optimism. And they said it as a criticism, and being the hopeless optimist that I am, I took it as a compliment.
And I would too.
but the other part of it, Mindy, is that what I'm hoping for is that business people will read it, and that one. Every business is fundamentally different from every other one, with different values, different culture, different aspirations. And I'm just hoping that people will read it, and one of the stories or one of the types of employee ownership will inspire each one to go, oh my God, that sounds like me. Mm-hmm. That sounds like us. That sounds like the business we want to be. That sounds like our future. I'll take it. So that's really what I hope for the book.
The book is From Founder to Future, A Business Roadmap to Impact, Longevity, and Employee Ownership. And we'll have a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. John Abrams, thanks for being here. So good to see you.
It's great to see you, Mindy. Thanks so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.